Welcome to Cut and Thrust, your podcast for the bloody and sometimes bizarre journey through the Middle Ages. Whether it's dark battles, questionable hygiene, or hair-raising rulers, here you'll get history as it really was, raw and unfiltered. So grab your sword, put on your helmet, and let's dive into the wild world of the past.
Hello and welcome to a new episode of the Battle Merchant Podcast. I'm Hendrik.
And I'm Carmen, and today we are diving into a really exciting topic, namely the Christianization of the Vikings.
Between Mjolnir and the cross, between Thor's hammer and the crucifix, a process that stretched over centuries and fundamentally transformed the entire Scandinavian world. But before we dive in, we first need to talk about the Vikings themselves. Because there's an image in people's heads that we really need to set straight.
The image of the wild plunderer who comes thundering to the coast in a longship and raids monasteries. Sure, that happened. Lindisfarne in 793, that's the iconic moment. But the reality for the vast majority of Scandinavians looked completely different. Most of the population were farmers, craftsmen, fishermen, traders. They never raided a monastery in their entire lives. Archaeological evidence shows this quite clearly. Settlement excavations reveal farmland, livestock barns, workshops. Weapon graves make up only a small proportion of burials, varying by region and time period.
And the trade routes were enormous. From Scandinavia along the rivers of Russia, all the way to Constantinople and Baghdad, westward to the British Isles. Furs, amber, honey and iron were exported. Silver, spices and silk came back. These were highly organized networks. The key to all this mobility was, of course, shipbuilding technology. The clinker build technique with overlapping planks made the hulls flexible enough for the open sea. But the shallow keel also allowed them to land on rivers and beaches. This combination was quite unique in Europe at the time.
And it was precisely this mobility that also brought the Scandinavians into contact with Christianity. Not just through raids, but equally through trade. In trading centers like Hedeby near present-day Schleswig or Bilka in Sweden, Christian merchants and Christian slaves were already living. People encountered the new faith almost in passing, at the market stall, so to speak.
Although you have to understand the belief system of the Vikings first, because it wasn't just simply
mythology. It was lived, everyday practice. Odin, Thor, Freya, these weren't just characters from stories. The Vikings regularly held blots, sacrificial feasts where animals were slaughtered. The blood, called hlaut, was collected in bowls and then sprinkled over the attendees and the sacrificial site using branches. Afterward, there was a large communal feast. It was both a religious act and a social event at the same time.
And then there were the vøvar, the seeresses. Women of very high social status who practiced seither magic, a kind of trance ritual for divination. They travelled between the courts and were paid for their services. In the Eiriks saga Röða, these seeresses are described in considerable detail. And then, of course, the amulets, the Thor's hammers made of silver or bronze, which turn up in archaeological finds in huge numbers, from Birka all the way to Iceland.
So this belief system was deeply rooted in everyday life. There was no separation between religion and daily life. Offerings were made before meals. A blot was performed in times of illness. Sacred groves and springs were visited. Old Uppsala in Sweden was probably one of the most important cult centers, at least according to the chronicler Adam of Bremen, although his description of the temple has not been conclusively confirmed by archaeology. And into this firmly established world, Christianity now slowly began to make its way.
That's the crucial point. It came in slowly. It wasn't a switch that was flipped. The Christianization of the Vikings was a process that stretched over roughly from the 9th to the 13th century, depending on which region you're looking at.
200 to 300 years, at least. And with massive regional differences. Denmark was the earliest. By 948, the first bishoprics had already been established there, in Schleswig, Ribe and Aarhus. Norway followed shortly after. But Sweden took the longest. There, the already Christianized Goethe in the south faced off against the pagan Svea in the north. In the 1080s, under Blodsvein, there were pagan uprisings and violent conflicts. Sweden didn't get its own archbishopric in Uppsala until 1164.
And Iceland officially adopted Christianity in the year 1000 at the Althing. But in private, pagan rituals continued to be practiced for a long time. That shows just how complex this entire process was.
What always fascinates me about this is the question of why. Why would a Scandinavian farmer or jarl give up his old faith? And the answer isn't primarily conviction. It was often purely pragmatic. If you wanted to trade with Christian kingdoms, being a Christian simply made things easier. Trade agreements, political alliances, military protection, all of that suddenly became accessible.
The first missionaries who came to Scandinavia were often sent by neighboring Christian realms. Ansgar, the so-called Apostle of the North, founded the first church in Birka around 830. And around 850, he received permission to preach in Hedeby. These missionaries were received by local rulers because they recognized the political advantages
of closer ties with the Christian world. It was realpolitik. The contacts with the Frankish Empire and Anglo-Saxon England that the blog post, that historical research emphasizes so much, those weren't just cultural exchange. They were strategic connections.
And with that, we've actually already set the stage for the whole story. Vikings who weren't mere plunderers, but a complex society with deeply rooted religious practices. And then this world encounters Christianity, not as a one-time event, but as a centuries-long, regional, often contradictory process of transformation.
And this is exactly where it gets really exciting. The motives behind the conversion, the key figures, the strategies and conflicts. This is a story you really need to savor. When you look at the motives behind this conversion process, the picture is confirmed. Genuine inner enlightenment was the rarest of cases. This was cold, calculated power politics.
And it starts with trade relations. If you were a Scandinavian merchant wanting to do business in Christian territories, being a pagan put you at a massive disadvantage. Christian trading partners preferred fellow believers. Contracts were concluded under Christian law. Markets were under church protection. So you had to find some way to work within that system.
And that's where a concept comes into play that perfectly illustrates the pragmatism of the Vikings.
The prim signing, the prima signatio. This was essentially a preliminary step before baptism. A priest would mark the Scandinavian with the sign of the cross, often with consecrated oil, and after that you were considered, well, Christian enough. You were allowed to trade at Christian markets, you had legal protection, you fell under Christian jurisdiction. But you weren't baptized.
Basically a business license with a religious veneer. The Viking could continue praying to Thor, celebrating his blots, wearing his Thor's hammer, while at the same time trading completely legally at Frankish or Anglo-Saxon marketplaces. That's a level of diplomatic flexibility you almost have to admire.
And this was apparently quite common. Egil's saga even describes it explicitly. Numerous Scandinavian merchants and warriors accepted the prim signing without ever taking the next step to full baptism, even though we don't know the exact numbers. It was a compromise that benefited both sides. The Christians could say they had brought the pagans closer to the faith, and the Vikings kept their religious freedom.
Although the missionaries sent to Scandinavia, of course, wanted more than just prim signing, they wanted full conversion. And that's where it gets really interesting, because they were dispatched by Christian kingdoms, often at the risk of their lives. Ansgar of Bremen is the best example. He arrived in Birka in 829 and was already attacked by pirates on the way there. His ship was plundered, and he lost his valuable books and the gifts intended for the Swedish king Björn.
He had to cover the rest of the journey on foot, and yet he managed to establish a first mission station in Birka. King Björn received him warmly, and some people were baptized, among them the local prefect Hergeir. But as soon as Ansgar left, everything fell apart. The priest left behind, Gautbert, was driven out, and the population returned to the old faith.
And then, in 845, disaster struck on top of it all, when Vikings sacked Hamburg of all places, Ansgar's own episcopal seat. He had to flee with a relic and relocate his bishopric to Bremen. The man truly experienced everything that could possibly go wrong.
When he returned to Birka again, around 852, the locals advised him to flee because his life was in danger. King Olaf wanted to consult the Thing Assembly and the casting of lots before allowing anything. This shows how much the mission depended on local consent. The missionaries couldn't simply show up and preach. They needed the ruler's permission, and that came with political conditions attached.
That's exactly the key. The local rulers didn't receive the missionaries because they were convinced by the Christian God. They received them because the missionaries came as envoys of powerful Christian realms. Receiving a bishop signaled to the Frankish Empire, or England, a willingness to engage. And that opened doors to
military alliances, trade agreements, political legitimacy. Baptism was a diplomatic tool. A Scandinavian king who got baptized could suddenly negotiate on equal footing with Christian rulers. He gained access to an entire network.
Trade privileges, peace guarantees, tribute payments, marriage ties with Christian royal houses.
Church anointment as legitimation of rule.
And of course, that also had an internal effect. A king backed by Christianity had an entirely new instrument of power. The old tribal chieftains claimed descent from Odin. That was the classic mythic legitimation. But a Christian king claimed to rule by the grace of God. And that was a different category of legitimation altogether. With it, you could unite rival tribes under a shared religious identity instead of relying on different divine lineages.
Although in practice, things didn't always go that smoothly. By the way, if you find this topic exciting, feel free to subscribe or recommend this episode. It really helps us keep producing content like this. But back to the matter at hand. Many of these baptisms were purely strategic. The Annales Bettiniani report sham baptisms where Vikings fell back to paganism shortly afterward. And the baptismal gifts were definitely an incentive. Alfred the Great showered Guthrum with treasures at his baptism in 878. Whether anyone actually got baptized multiple times, though, isn't historically confirmed.
Baptism as a diplomatic transaction, so to speak, that's remarkably pragmatic.
This confirms what historical research keeps emphasizing. This process had little to do with inner conviction. Christianity offered the Vikings very concrete advantages. It helped resolve internal conflicts, it provided access to a European power structure, and economically it was simply more profitable than confrontation.
And this didn't only apply to the elites. Ordinary merchants had tangible reasons too. At a marketplace in the Frankish Empire, you needed the protection of Christian law. Without primsigning or baptism, you had no legal protection, no contract enforcement, no right to peace. At that point, conversion becomes a pure cost-benefit analysis.
Which the missionaries were well aware of. They knew that many of these baptisms remained superficial. Ansgar himself probably experienced how people immediately reverted after his departure. But the strategy was designed for the long term. First win over the rulers, then reach the population through churches and education. And that's exactly what worked over generations.
It was an interplay of external pressure and internal interests. The Christian realms used their economic and military power to promote conversion. And the Scandinavian elites used conversion to strengthen their own position. Not a purely religious process, but a deeply political and economic one.
And the whole story plays out in this tension between genuine faith and cold calculation. What this meant in concrete terms for individual rulers is well worth a closer look. Now we need to talk about a figure who embodies this entire conversion process like no other. King Harald Gormson, better known as Harald Bluetooth. And with him, it becomes especially clear just how closely religion and power politics were intertwined. Harald became king of Denmark around 958, son of Gorm the Old and Queen Thyra. And he had a concrete problem. He needed a way to consolidate his rule over the various tribal territories, while simultaneously being taken seriously as a partner by the Christian realms.
And that's where Christianity comes into play. It was no longer just a prim signing for trade privileges, as it had been for many other Scandinavian leaders. Harald went all the way. Around 965, he was baptized and began actively promoting Christianity in his realm. He had churches built and appointed Christian priests as advisors. But the crucial point is, this was less a spiritual awakening than a political calculation of impressive foresight.
And there's a fascinating legend surrounding his baptism. A cleric named Poppo, whose exact origins are uncertain, is said to have undergone a trial by ordeal before Harald. He allegedly carried red-hot iron in his bare hands without being burned. This supposedly impressed Harald so much that he agreed to be baptized. The story comes from Widukind of Corvey, a Saxon chronicler who wrote it down just a few years after the event.
Although we need to be careful here. Widukind's account is the only contemporary source for this episode. Later chroniclers like Adam of Bremen in the 11th century vary the details but bring no new evidence. Harald's baptism itself is confirmed archaeologically and by the Yelling Stones, but whether the trial by ordeal with the red-hot iron actually happened that way, or whether Widukind was trying to legitimise Ottonian missionary policy, that remains an open question.
Which brings us to perhaps the most important material testimony of this entire conversion story, the Greater Yelling Stone. A granite block, nearly 2.5 meters tall, inscribed and decorated on three sides. And the inscription packs quite a punch. In essence, it reads, King Harald ordered this stone to be made in memory of Gorm, his father, and Thyra, his mother. The Harald who won all of Denmark, claimed influence in Norway, and made the Danes Christian. At least according to his own self-portrayal.
This made the Danes Christian. that is essentially a national founding act carved in runes. It's no coincidence that the stone is often called Denmark's baptismal certificate. And the pictorial side features one of the earliest known figural depictions of Christ in the Nordic region. Only simpler crosses and crucifixes from Hedeby are older. This clothed, triumphant figure, surrounded by interlace patterns, is a complete pictorial novelty. On the other side, an animal entwined by a serpent, probably a lion. Since 1994, the entire Jelling complex has been a UNESCO World Heritage Site.
And what you can see in the inscription is Harald's dual message. He combines a political claim to power, all of Denmark and Norway, with the religious act of Christianization. This is no humble profession of faith. This is a manifesto.
It's propaganda carved in granite. He simultaneously legitimizes himself as a conqueror and as a missionary. And by doing so, he positions himself on equal footing with the Ottonian emperors and the Frankish kings. A pagan tribal chieftain would never have been an equal partner to them. But a Christian king with his own claim to sovereignty, that was a completely different basis for negotiation.
Although we mustn't forget the geopolitical context. Since the Treaty of Verdun in 843, when the Carolingian Empire was divided into three, Christian kingdoms lay in
direct proximity to Scandinavia. But we shouldn't overstate that connection. The treaty changed the political map and created East and West Francia as independent Christian powers. That increased the pressure and the points of contact with Scandinavia, but it was one factor among many, not a trigger. Missionary activity had already begun before that, and the actual conversion came more than 100 years after Verdun.
That's an important point. Verdun created structures that facilitated the process. Stronger, independent Christian realms with their own missionary policies. But the direct cause of Herod's conversion was his own political calculation, not the partition of 843.
What Harald essentially did was change the rules of the game. Instead of relying on the traditional legitimation through divine descent from the gods, he used Christian anointment as a new instrument of power. He had churches built, brought clergy into the country, who also served as administrative experts, and thereby created an infrastructure that stabilized his rule.
And now, a quick word from our sponsor. Feeling curious? Then head over to battlemerchant.com. They've got all sorts of medieval stuff, from costumes to armor and loads more. Totally worth a look.
And the curious thing is that this Viking king from the 10th century is actually a household name today without most people even realizing it. Bluetooth technology is named after him. Jim Kardec from Intel suggested the name in the late 90s because Harald united different tribes just as Bluetooth is meant to connect different devices. And the Bluetooth logo is a bint rune of Harald's initials in the Younger Futhark, an H and a B overlaid on top of each other.
A Viking king as the namesake for a technology we use every day. There's something wonderful about that. But it also shows how enduringly Harald's legacy is perceived. This idea of unification that he had carved into the Jelling stone has clearly had a lasting impact right into the 21st century.
And for the history of conversion, Harald is the turning point. He demonstrated that Christianity could be used not just as a trade license, but as a comprehensive political system. A system that legitimized rule, enabled administration, and brought international recognition. That was the blueprint that other Scandinavian kings followed after him.
The remarkable thing about this religious transformation is that it was not a clean break. There was no moment when the Vikings said, "Right, from now on we're Christians. That's the end of the old gods." Instead, both belief systems blended together over centuries. It's called syncretism, this creative merging of religions where something entirely new emerges.
And you can see this concretely in the archaeological record. There's a casting mold from Hedebu, 9th to 10th century, where a craftsman could cast Thor's hammer pendants on one side and cross pendants on the other. Same metal worker, same tool, two belief systems. And then there are pieces like the so-called wolf cross, a pendant that combines the T-shape of the Thor's hammer with a cross. However, the authenticity of such combination finds is often disputed. What is confirmed above all are the casting molds themselves.
Such amulets, if they're genuine, unite both worlds. The wearer was hedging their bets, if you will. Thor's protection and Christ's blessing. And that reflects an entire transitional mentality. You see something similar on runestones. Christian crosses become the central motif, while the inscriptions continue to be carved in runes, sometimes even with invocations to Thor alongside Christian formulas. Both belief systems coexisted side by side.
And then there's the question of how the Vikings actually perceived Jesus himself. They didn't see him as a suffering man on the cross, as was common in the continental European tradition. In Scandinavia, Christ was depicted as the Hvitur Kristur, the White Christ, a victorious king who had conquered death, crowned with open eyes in royal garments, a triumphant ruler. That fit much better into a culture where gods were venerated as mighty, powerful figures.
The Vikings essentially interpreted Christ through the lens of their own culture. A god who dies and is resurrected, who defeats death itself. For a society that worshipped Odin and Thor, that was something they could relate to. And the veneration of saints offered another bridge. Patron saints responsible for specific areas of life bore a strong structural resemblance to the Norse protective deities. Thor for thunder and seafaring, St. Olaf for the protection of sailors. There are direct
parallels, and the missionaries were well aware of this. They deliberately used these points of connection. The same applies to the festival calendar. Yule, the Norse midwinter feast, which is described in the Heimskringla as a three-day festival with sacrifices and a great communal meal, was quite deliberately merged with the Christian celebration of Christmas.
King Hakon the Good initiated this convergence in the 10th century. The shift of Yule to December 25th happened gradually. The customs were largely allowed to continue, the brewing of beer, the feast, the communal gathering, but the religious framework was reinterpreted in Christian terms. The old toast, "Til aus och friðr," meaning "for a good harvest and peace," was not replaced but expanded, according to legal texts like the Gulathing law. "Till Krist thakka och sancta Mariu, till aus och friðr." Christ and Mary were added, but the prayer for a good harvest remained. And terms like Yule for Christmas have survived in the Scandinavian languages to this day.
This shows how skillfully the integration worked. People weren't forbidden from celebrating. Instead, the occasion was reframed. And this extends into architecture. The Norwegian stave churches are a fantastic example. In Borgund, there's one built around 1180, made of wood, using the stave construction technique. The load-bearing structure relies on ingenious timber joints, entirely without metal nails. And perched on the roof ridges are dragon heads, taken directly from the Viking ship tradition. Interlace carvings in the Urnes style on the portals, intertwined animal motifs that clearly originate from Norse ornamentation.
Dragon heads on a Christian church.
Dedicated to the Apostle Andrew.
That's syncretism, carved in wood. The master builders put their familiar craft traditions in the service of the new faith. And the church apparently tolerated this, because it increased local acceptance.
Although this transition naturally had its losers too. Socially, the church introduced new norms. Marriage, inheritance, criminal law. Everything was reshaped along Christian lines. And especially when it comes to
women's roles, we need to be more nuanced. The blog post, well, the common narrative, often says broadly that women lost status through the conversion. And that's partly true. Divorce rights, for example, which women had previously held, were restricted or abolished under Christian law. Women could previously initiate a divorce and receive a substantial share of the property. That was taken away.
And at the same time, women in pagan society could independently own property and conduct trade. Archaeological finds from Hedebü show wealthy women with their own possessions. And women even commissioned runestones, like Queen Esfrid, the first recorded Danish queen, who in the 10th century had the famous Hedebü stones erected in memory of her son Sigtrygg. Keys found in women's graves symbolized their role as head of the household.
But it's not solely a story of loss. Convents offered women an alternative to forced marriage, a space for education and a degree of self-determination. And in Sweden, there's evidence that women were actually a driving force behind the conversion. Runestones with invocations to the Virgin Mary, commissioned by women. And regionally, it varied enormously. In Iceland, where the conversion didn't come until around 1000, women retained many of their old rights far longer than in Denmark, for instance.
This shows that you can't make sweeping generalizations. It was a complex, multi-layered transformation that meant different things to different people in different places. Some gained, some lost. And the church also brought something entirely new: education and literacy. Monasteries and schools became centers of knowledge. The Latin alphabet came to Scandinavia, even though runes continued to be used in parallel. In the long run, this shift to written culture is what made it possible for the old sagas and myths to be written down and preserved in the first place.
Which is quite an irony. Without the monks who brought the art of writing, we wouldn't have the Edda. We wouldn't have the sagas. None of what we know today about the pre-Christian Norse world. The conversion didn't just displace the old culture. It saved parts of it for posterity.
What makes this entire process so remarkable is the role that the church assumed in the long term, as we've already seen with Harald Bluetooth. Not just as a religious institution, but as a veritable foundation of power. Bishops and priests became the closest advisors to kings. They brought administrative expertise, could read and write, and understood the European legal system. That was a competence no tribal elder could offer.
And this interconnection of church and state was an enormous advantage for Scandinavian rulers. The church offered a ready-made administrative model. Dioceses as regional units, canon law as a legal framework, monasteries as repositories of knowledge. This significantly shaped the formation of kingdoms in Denmark, Norway, and Sweden, though it was only one of several important factors.
And the monasteries in particular played a role that can hardly be overstated. They became Scandinavia's first true centres of learning. The Latin alphabet arrived, schools were founded,
and literacy spread from the monasteries into administration, legislation, and eventually into broader society. Before that, there were runes, which were used for inscriptions in stone and wood, sometimes very elaborate and complex. But longer, continuous texts, administrative documents, legal codes in book form, only became possible with the Latin writing system on parchment.
And in the long term, this contributed to Scandinavia's cultural flourishing. The great legal works like the Gragas in Iceland or the Gulathing Law in Norway, these are products of this shift to written culture. Without the monasteries, they would never have come into being.
Although we need to be careful not to tell this story as a linear narrative of progress, from warlike pagans to civilized Christians, that's
too simplistic. The Vikings weren't uncivilized barbarians before the conversion, and they didn't automatically become peaceful afterward. The narrative of going from raiders to traders obscures the fact that trade and long-distance voyaging had been the backbone of the Scandinavian economy long before the conversion. The conversion made trade easier and changed political structures, but it didn't create a fundamentally different society.
And conversely, Christian Scandinavians were still involved in wars. The Norwegian Crusades in the 12th century, the Danish conquests in the Baltic, these weren't peaceful trading missions. The conversion changed the methods and the justification, but not the fundamental character of an expansive, mobile society.
What really changed was Scandinavia's integration into the European framework. The Scandinavian kingdoms became full members of medieval Christendom, with everything that entailed: marriage alliances, participation in the Crusades, ecclesiastical networks, diplomatic relations on equal footing. That was the real transformation.
And the reach of this transformation was enormous. The conversion didn't remain confined to the Scandinavian heartland. Via Iceland and Greenland, it even reached the North Atlantic. Leif Erikson, who was baptized around 999 by King Olaf Tryggvason in Norway, was given the explicit mission to bring Christianity to Greenland. His mother, Thjodhildr, converted and had a small church built at Brattahlid, which has been confirmed archaeologically. His father, Erik the Red, however, refused to convert until the very end.
And as we know, Leif sailed on to Vinland, North America, around the year 1000. In doing so, the Vikings indirectly carried Christianity across the Atlantic as well, even though no permanent settlement or mission was established in Vinland. But the fact that a freshly baptized Scandinavian set foot on North American soil 500 years before Columbus, that shows the incredible reach of this process.
And the Norse legacy is still present in our everyday lives today. Often without us even, well, without us being aware of it. Our days of the week, for example. Tuesday comes from Tyr, the god of war. Wednesday is still clearly connected. It's Vårdens day, Odin's day. Thursday is Tors day. Friday is usually associated with Frigg, though some say Freya. In Danish, it's even more obvious. Tirsdag, onsdag, torsdag, fredag.
The entire Norse pantheon is embedded right there in our ordinary week. That's, when you think about it, a remarkably living memory of a culture that officially converted to Christianity 1,000 years ago.
And that's exactly what this episode was really trying to show. Cultural change is never black and white. The conversion didn't erase everything Norse. On the contrary, much of it lives on, in language, in symbols, in traditions, in the myths that monks wrote down. It was a blending, not a replacement.
And I think that's what makes this story so relevant. Societies don't change at the flick of a switch. They negotiate, they blend, they preserve and innovate at the same time. The Vikings between Mjölnir and the Cross, that's essentially a story about the ability of cultures to adapt without completely giving themselves up.
And if you're looking for more stories like this, by the way, it's well worth checking out battlemerchant.com. On the blog, you'll find plenty of topics about the Vikings and other historical eras. And in the shop, there's a huge selection for anyone who doesn't just want to read about history, but experience it.
With that in mind, thank you so much for listening. We hope the journey between Thor's hammer and the cross has fascinated you as much as it has us.
Until next time.
And so we ride towards the end of this episode. Keep your sword sharp and your mugs full. We'll catch you in the next one.